The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Hello, this is Suzanne Stroud for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Money Matters. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer and the Triangle Business Journal. Home builders' stock market values soar since COVID onset, but we see muted start in 2022. Publicly traded home builders have seen their stock market values surge since the COVID-19 pandemic, but 2022 has gotten off to a rockier start. Still, builders have grown immensely in the 2 years since the pandemic began, including small to medium-sized groups. That's owed to a huge run-up in demand for housing nationally, even amid labor and material shortages, spikes in commodities like lumber, and supply chain woes. Among 22 builders, Matawan, New Jersey-based Hovnavian Enterprises, Inc., saw the biggest gains in its market capitalization since March 16, 2020 and December 31, 2021, at 1,903%, according to research by the business journals. Its market cap grew from $42.9 million at the start of the pandemic to $859.6 million at the end of 2021. Greenwood Village, Colorado-based Century Communities, Inc., ranked number two, posting a market cap gain of 423% from $527.5 million in March 2020 to $1.46 billion at the end of the year, the business journals found. Large builders have only gotten bigger, too. Toll Brothers, Inc., of Fort Washington, Pennsylvania, one of the largest publicly traded builders, saw its market cap grow from $2.41 billion at the start of the pandemic to $5.43 billion at the end of 2021. Its current estimated market cap is in excess of $6 billion. The stock market has been volatile in the first 2 months of 2022. In the past 6 months, stock prices among most public builders peaked at the end of 2021, before beginning to drop in January, modestly at first, and then more steadily in mid to late January. Stock prices are still largely higher than where they were right before the pandemic. Using Toll Brothers as an example, its stock price was $18.22 on March 16, 2020, a meaningful drop compared to what it had been in the weeks leading up to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention officially declaring COVID-19 a pandemic on March 11, 2020. Since then, Toll Brothers' stock price peaked at $76.61 on December 10, 2021, and was $51.60 as of late afternoon, March 9th. Arlington-based Texas D.R. Horton, Inc., the largest home builder by market cap, grew 236% between March 16, 2020, and the close of 2021. Its market cap on December 31st was $38.63 billion, although now it's slightly higher than $29 billion. Its stock price went from $31.35 on March 16th, 2020, to a pandemic peak of $109.65 on December 10th, 2021. Its stock price late on March 9th was $82.65. Several home builders cited impacts from the Omicron variant in recent earnings calls from the quarter that closed 2021 as exacerbating issues the home building industry was already grappling with. Trade partners were unable to work or had leaner staffs because of a rise in COVID-19 infections. Cabinets, windows, and garage doors were among the materials difficult to obtain in the final months of 2021 because of the pandemic's impact on labor, said Ara Hovnanian, CEO of Hovnanian Enterprises, during the company's March 1 call discussing earnings of its first quarter of fiscal 2022, which ended January 31, 2022. Hovnanian said some backordered items and delays in final inspections prevented the company from closing homes nationally. All these issues combined resulted in longer construction cycle times and delays in home deliveries, he said. This pushed some of our expected first quarter deliveries into the second quarter and caused us to miss our revenue guidance. Total reported revenue for Hovnanian in Q1 2022 was $565 million, and the company has been able to offset higher material and labor costs with home prices, Hovnanian said. Douglas Yearley, chairman and CEO of Toll Brothers, also referenced additional pressure from Omicron on the supply chain during the company's February 23rd earnings call for Q1 fiscal 2022, which ended January 31st. He said it's taking the builder approximately 2 months longer to deliver a home today than it did 1 year ago. With demand and pricing as strong as they have been, and with construction schedules that continue to extend due to supply chain, labor, and similar issues, we believe the right strategy for us at this time is to limit sales and continue to focus on production, Yearley said. He said Toll Brothers planned to ramp up speculative starts in its second quarter, which began in February, and purposely meter sales. That's an approach many builders have taken since the pandemic to conserve their inventory and ultimately achieve higher prices. Inflation, rising costs dominate small business worries. Inflation continues to top a long list of concerns for small business owners, according to a new survey. About 33% of small business owners now rank inflation as the biggest challenge facing the small business community, up 10 percentage points from the end of 2021. About 85% of small business owners say they are concerned about the impact of inflation on their business, according to new data from MetLife and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Special Report on Inflation and Supply Chain Shocks on Small Businesses. The report cited Federal Reserve data showing prices rose more than 6% over the past year, the highest level since 1982. About 39% of small business owners reported they had taken out a loan in the past year in response to growing inflationary pressures. COVID-19 is still a concern, but has been surpassed by both inflation and supply chain challenges. Each of those two challenges could be strained by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, according to economists and global trade consultants. Having survived the pandemic, now small business owners are being hit with surging inflation. It's limiting their purchasing power and forcing small businesses to raise their own prices and absorb higher costs within already thin margins, said Neil Bradley, Executive Vice President and Chief Policy Officer at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We need policymakers to pursue policies that will reduce inflationary pressures, including addressing the worker shortage crisis, expanding trade, and reducing tariffs. But small business owners don't seem to have much faith in policymakers, according to a separate survey of 7,326 small business owners by Small Business Network, Alignable in early February. On average, only 16% of the small business owners polled said they approved of the job the federal government is doing for them. About 21% approve of President Biden's efforts, while 13% approved of the U.S. Senate and 14% approved of the U.S. House of Representatives. Respondents had higher approval ratings for governors, 34%, and local representatives, 31%. It's worth noting the political affiliation of the survey breaks down to 33% Republican, 18% Democrat, 15% Independent, and 15% with no party affiliation, with the remainder being members of smaller political groups are opting not to identify their political preferences. Among self-described minority business owners, Biden scored a far higher 40% approval rating. But the relatively low overall marks come as lawmakers have spent months negotiating a combined but pared-down stimulus plan for the hardest-hit industries that could be tied into a larger omnibus piece of legislation, such as a full-year continuing resolution to fund the government. A Washington Post article identified negotiations in the Senate pegged to a $68 billion figure for a relief package. Representative Dean Phillips, Democrat of Minnesota, who has pushed for additional grant funding for the RRF and for the gyms, hotels, and live event industries, said in an interview earlier in 2022, there is no set number, although it's likely to be less. One source, with knowledge of the negotiations previously told the playbook, the lower bound for a stimulus package was currently around $40 billion, while the upper bound was around $60 billion. Meanwhile, small business owners still have to grapple with ongoing supply chain issues, according to a survey of small business CEOs by Vistage, a peer mentoring membership organization. That survey found 75% of small business CEOs said their vendors had increased prices due to inflation, while 54% had reported higher costs for raw materials. Another three-fourths of small business owners said the main supply chain challenge is simply the availability of goods and supplies and deliver delays. Small business leaders are also grappling with ongoing labor shortages, with 65% saying hiring challenges are impacting their ability to operate at full capacity. About 76% said they offered salary increases. Another 84% said they plan to offer additional salary increases to attract new workers. Small business owners across the country have had to increasingly pony up for workers. About 50% of small business owners said they raised pay over the last 3 months, according to a separate survey by the National Federation of Independent Business, a 48-year high. But companies scrambling for workers in the tight labor market are in for a long and rough road and need to find new ways to reach disinterested workers, according to a new analysis. The current labor shortage is actually a 1-2 punch of decades of low population growth that has led to fewer working-age people and a precipitous drop in immigration that reached a crescendo just as the COVID-19 pandemic knocked millions of people out of the workforce, according to a new report by data and analytics firm MC Burning Glass. Should North Carolina pension fund be able to sue to seize Russian properties? As several states move to divest their pension funds from holdings tied to Russia, NC State Treasurer Dale Folwell called on Congress Wednesday to make it easier for states to recoup losses in another way, by seeking damages in court that could result in the seizure of Russian assets. State lawmakers in Raleigh are also considering calling for Congress to make the change as part of a proposed resolution condemning the Russian invasion. About $80 million in North Carolina's state pension fund is invested in assets based in or tied to Russia as of February 25th, according to Folwell's office. That amount is less than 0.7% of the fund's $118.2 billion in total holdings, but it still represents a significant amount of taxpayer money invested in assets that have been quickly depreciating since Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine on February 24th. The state's supplemental retirement plans, which consist of the NC 401k, 457, and 403b plans, also have about $2 billion out of a total of $15.5 billion in holdings invested in companies based in Russia. In total, North Carolina pensioners and taxpayers have approximately $90 million in exposure to Russian entities, Folwell told the News and Observer in an interview. To protect North Carolina pensioners from the losses stemming from these investments and simultaneously punish the Russian government for its actions in Ukraine, the state should be able to recoup losses by suing in U.S. courts to seize Russian assets and properties, Folwell said. We need to punish Putin and his cronies for pension and investment losses, Folwell said in a news release referring to the Russian president. North Carolina taxpayers and those who teach, protect, and otherwise serve should not suffer that burden. Foreign-owned property is generally exempt from seizure under U.S. law, but there are some exceptions under a law known as the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act of 1976, particularly for property used in commercial activity. The law should be amended by Congress to include additional exceptions to empower state pension funds and other institutional investors to seek damages and impose serious financial consequences on the Russian government for a barbarous and deplorable war, Folwell said. Multiple states have said they intend to divest from Russian entities and are exploring how to do so. On Monday, a bipartisan group of 38 state treasurers issued a statement saying they support efforts at all levels of government and across the public and private sectors to divest state treasury and pension funds from holdings in Russian-based companies. Divestment for the North Carolina Pension Fund isn't possible right now, Folwell said Wednesday, since the fund's custodian has stopped all trading of Russian investments. Even if the fund could divest right now, it would be for pennies on the dollar, and that wouldn't do anything to rectify that our pensioners and taxpayers have been punished by Putin, Folwell said. Folwell said North Carolina pensioners should rest assured that they continue to participate in one of the strongest pension plans in the United States, if not the world. The holdings in the state pension fund that are tied to Russia are not direct investments made by the NC Department of State Treasurer, Folwell said, but are included in international equity and index funds the state invests in, which are managed by its custodian. State Treasury officials have no say in what goes into those international funds, Folwell said. And the state has been investing in the funds since they were created, some of them more than a decade ago. Under the federal law, FSIA, property in the United States owned by other countries cannot be seized through lawsuits, except in a few situations, according to the Congressional Research Service. Folwell said the law could be amended to allow economically injured parties to file additional court actions against Russian entities. Doing so would give potential plaintiffs, like state pension funds, more legal grounds to confiscate Russian assets to compensate for the economic harm resulting from investments in Russian entities losing value. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill were finalizing a $14 billion aid package for Ukraine, which was expected to be included in a giant domestic funding bill that must be passed by midnight on Friday to avert a government shutdown, the Washington Post reported. Folwell said that adding the necessary changes to FSIA that would allow states to pursue damages against Russia to the Ukrainian assistance package seemed like the best way to amend the law. Prior to announcing his proposal on Wednesday, Folwell said he had discussed it with both U.S. Senators Richard Burr and Tom Tillis and shared it with the entire congressional delegation from North Carolina. In a post on Twitter, Tillis said he supported Folwell's idea and felt it was the right thing to do. This would send a clear message that the U.S. will not support any holdings or operations that benefit Putin and his illicit war crimes, he said. It remains unclear if congressional lawmakers will act on Folwell's proposal. A spokesperson for Tillis's office did not respond Wednesday afternoon to a request for comment on how and when the proposal might be considered by lawmakers. The State Employees Association of North Carolina said in a news release Wednesday about Folwell's announcement that his members applaud him for protecting state employees and retirees' livelihoods, and we stand behind him in support of the Ukrainian people against an invasion of their country. For more North Carolina government and political news, listen to Under the Dome Politics podcast from the News and Observer and the NC Insider. You can find it at the News and Observer website. Amgen adds to Holly Springs' growing biotech clout. Southern Wake County is continuing to become a significant player in the biotech industry as industry giant Amgen broke ground Monday on a manufacturing facility that could eventually employ more than 350 people. Amgen's new plant, which is scheduled to open by 2025, will be built down the road from another massive biotech investment from Fujifilm Diosynth, which is building a $1.5 billion plant that could employ more than 700 people. Pharmaceutical company Seqirus also has a significant facility in the town. It's the culmination of a years-long strategy from the town of Holly Springs, home to both the Amgen and Fujifilm plants, which has for years worked to attract life science companies. Holly Springs really positioned themselves to do this, said Wake County Commissioner Zig Hutchison Monday at a groundbreaking event for Amgen. Hutchison noted the town has become a generous partner in finding land deals, offering incentives, and making it easier for construction to get underway within the town's boundaries. Holly Springs is also benefiting from the fact that land prices in Research Triangle Park, historically home to most of the region's biotech activities, has gotten more expensive in the past decade. I think there's a lot more to come down here, Hutchison added. Since the pandemic started, there has been a wave of investment in putting more biotech manufacturing in the U.S. Amgen, in addition to the Holly Springs facility, is also building a plant in Ohio. Together, the two plants will employ more than 700 people. The Holly Springs plant will make the active ingredients that go into the many drugs Amgen manufactures, including ones for heart disease, osteoporosis, and psoriatic arthritis. Amgen announced its Holly Springs expansion late August after it received state and local incentives worth more than $35 million, the News and Observer previously reported. The jobs will pay on average $119,510. Robert Bradway, Amgen's chief executive officer, said the North Carolina and Ohio plants are critical for meeting increased demands for its products. The demographics are in our favor, Bradway said in an interview. We have an aging population globally. As people age, they become more vulnerable to chronic diseases like cardiovascular disease, cancer, osteoporosis, therapies where we're very active in advancing. These two expansion facilities will enable us to continue to grow to meet the demand for our medicines, he said. Bradway added that Amgen's investment was made possible because of federal tax reform that came in 2017. Amgen was one of the biggest winners of that tax reform, which let companies repatriate cash that had been held overseas, MarketWatch reported. I want to underscore that we were able to make a decision to put these jobs back here in North Carolina and in Ohio, thanks to the tax reform that happened several years ago, Bradway said. That reform made these locations competitive with others elsewhere in the world. Bradway said many companies like Amgen had been considering expansions outside of the U.S. until that reform. Amgen officials said they considered more than a dozen locations before picking Holly Springs, which the company said had important access to both talent and other life science companies. In particular, Bradway said Amgen was interested in the Triangle because of its diverse population. Amgen is one of dozens of large U.S. companies to join an effort called 110, which was formed after the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis at the hands of the police. The effort aims to unite companies in an effort to hire 1 million Black Americans to good-paying jobs over the next 10 years. Governor Roy Cooper, who attended Monday's groundbreaking, said North Carolina is ready to work with Amgen to find diverse talent. He noted that the state has more four-year, historically Black colleges and universities than any other state. You want to hire a diverse workforce. We can help with that, Cooper said at the event. In North Carolina, diversity is not only the right thing to do, it is better for the bottom line. For its part, Amgen said it also planned to hire more workers without four-year degrees and offer more training opportunities. Amgen also said it would introduce its Amgen Biotech Experience Program to some Wake County schools. The program gives middle school and high school students a chance to work with high-tech lab equipment and introduce them to careers in biotech. Amgen said it hopes to launch the program locally this fall. Once a powerful symbol in Russia, McDonald's withdraws. 2 months after the Berlin Wall fell, another powerful symbol opened its doors in the middle of Moscow, a gleaming new McDonald's. It was the first American fast food restaurant to enter the Soviet Union, reflecting the new political openness of the era. For Vlad Vexler, who was a 9-year-old, waited in a 2-hour line to enter the restaurant near Moscow's Pushkin Square on its opening day in January 1990. It was a gateway to the utopia he imagined the West to be. So it was all the more poignant for Vexler when McDonald's announced it would temporarily close that store and nearly 850 others in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. That McDonald's is a sign of optimism that in the end didn't materialize, said Vexler, a political philosopher and author who now lives in London. Now that Russia is entering the period of contraction, isolation, and impoverishment, you look back at these openings and think about what might have been. McDonald's said in a statement that at this juncture, it's impossible to predict when we might be able to reopen our restaurants in Russia, but it is continuing to pay its 62,500 Russian employees. The company said this week that it expects the closure to cost around $50 million per month. Just as McDonald's paved the way for other brands to enter the Soviet market, its exit led to a cascade of similar announcements from other U.S. brands. Starbucks closed its 130 outlets in Russia. Yum! Brands closed 70 company-owned KFC restaurants and was negotiating the closure of 50 Pizza Huts that are owned by franchisees. McDonald's entry into the Soviet Union began with a chance meeting. In 1976, McDonald's loaned some buses to organizers of the 1980 Moscow Olympics, who were touring Olympic venues in Montreal, Canada. George Cohan, then the head of McDonald's in Canada, took the visitors to McDonald's as part of the tour. That same night, the group began discussing ways to open a McDonald's in the Soviet Union. 14 years later, after Soviet laws loosened and McDonald's built relationships with local farmers, the first McDonald's opened in downtown Moscow. It was a sensation. On its opening day, the restaurant's 27 cash registers rang up 30,000 meals. McDonald's entry into the Soviet Union was so groundbreaking, it gave rise to a political theory. The Golden Arches theory holds that two countries that both have McDonald's in them won't go to war because the presence of a McDonald's is an indicator of the country's level of interdependence and their alignment with U.S. laws, said Bernard Kossler, a political science professor at James Madison University in Harrisburg, Virginia. That theory held until 2014, when Russia annexed Crimea and Kossler. We've run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you have enjoyed it. I am Suzanne Stroud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Money Matters is available on a podcast on our website, NC Reading Service.